That brings us to the end of this historic conversation between our guest Tim Page and Glenn Gould. And I have to say that it's very exciting to hear the spontaneity, because as we all know, at a certain point, Glenn began, becoming a screenwriter for his own interviews and scripting both the questions and his own answers. That's not what we were hearing here at all, was it?
Absolutely none of that was scripted. And I did another interview, a rather famous interview now, with him about little less than 2 years later, which was going to be used for the Goldberg Variations. It is the only time I met him in life, and we spent 2 days of intense conversation, and then we recorded the interview. I should maybe give a little bit of information about that, then I'll get back to the other thing. But with that, what happened was Glenn sent me the Goldberg Variations and asked me what I thought. And so I listened to the two recordings, and I gave him some ideas about questions that, you know, I might have. And so, lo and behold, without telling me a thing, he writes a script with me in it and with him. And he says, how would you like to come to Canada and record this? And so I looked the script over, and I didn't think some of the parts which he thought were funny were very funny. But of course, I wasn't about to say that. I think he's much, much funnier and much more real on what we just heard than he is on the Goldberg piece. But in that one, he didn't make me say anything I didn't believe, but he put that whole thing about Sir John and the filmmaker and all these things in, which I, you know, I'm not an actor. I was very tired. We were recording about 3 o'clock in the morning. And so I wish I'd done a better job of acting. There is no acting in this, none at all. It was also done late at night. This was at about 11 o'clock at night, going on to close to 2 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, it was purely spontaneous. I told him some of the things I wanted to talk about. But aside from that, if something came up in my mind or there was something I wanted to ask him about, I felt absolutely free to do it. And frankly, and I think he would agree, we really had a blast, as you can hear in that recording.
One thing that comes across from you is the sheer pleasure of someone having a serious, in-depth conversation with someone that he greatly admires. And, you know, as you said, I have admired for a long time. So your enthusiasm is very clear. What I detect from him is an appreciation for the kind of ideas and your willingness to get away from the stuff that he must have been just so sick of hearing over and over. Why do you wash your hands? And what about the arrowroot cookies? And is there something magical about Poland water? And, you know, all that kind of junk.
When are you going to make your historic return?
Exactly, exactly. So I thought that came across. And for those people who have never heard Glenn Gould's Silver Anniversary album, I bought it on vinyl when it was new. It really is terrific because some of it is previously unreleased material, so you get a chance to hear him play, for example, Scarlatti for the first time and explain why it is that he never wanted to record any more Scarlatti, and some things that are actually quite precious and wonderful, like his Bach Marcello Concerto, a recording which I happen to know actually saved one friend of ours' life, helped turn him around from thoughts of suicide because of it was so exquisitely beautiful that he decided he wanted to stay in the world. The second half is this extended radio play in which he is both making serious points and just taking the mickey out of a lot of the pretensions and the trends and the, to use his favorite word, zeitgeist of the classical music world, and in which he had a chance to bring back several of his friendly alter egos. So, of course, we had the German musicologist, or as Peter Schickele would say, musicologist, Dr. Karl-Heinz Klopfweiser, the Dean of British Conductors, Sir Nigel Twit-Thornwaite, loosely modeled, I think, after, well, any of your favorite British conductors, but I always like to think of him as Sir Adrian Bolt. And of course, my personal favorite, Theodore Slutz from the New York Village Grass is Greener, a character that I think pretty loosely is modeled after Marlon Brando in The Wild Ones. And
Richard Castellanets.
Right, Richard Castellanets, exactly. And of course, yes, yes,
remember
indeed.
Him?
And making his debut appearance, the sound engineer, Duncan Hague Guinness from the CBC. So anyone who hasn't heard it, and I should also, in due deference to a good friend of ours, Margaret Pachu, the female voice who appears both as herself and as the Hungarian dean of the Kodály Kindergarten from, behind the East Block, Marta Hortavanyi. So it's a blast. It's absolutely hilarious. And it is one of those times when Glenn's scripting actually is funny because he's not taking himself too seriously. And yet he is making some serious mm-hmm. points.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And also he gets grilled by his own alter egos in a way that I find really quite deliciously funny, because he gets to attribute to them all of the inane criticisms that various sort of more or less stodgy mainline music critics and others hurled at him over the years, and really, really does manage to, as the British would say, take the piss out of them. So one of the things that I found really fascinating that I didn't know is that all was recorded one line at a time. It kind of gives you a view of his way of producing, which in some ways was not this immaculately polished thing. You know, they were running around putting the speaker in the hallway and finally in the bathroom for Duncan's sort of, sound booth voice, all that sort of thing. Did you get a feeling as you got to know Glenn that he liked to experiment and try things out? And sometimes it was pretty low tech, as someone who's noted for being an advocate of technology.
Well, Glenn and I had planned to record the Goldberg interview, as I call it, in his studio at the former Inn on the Park. And for whatever reason, we couldn't do it. And so he called up Brian Doyle, who was a friend of his and turned out to be the engineer for this. And we went down to downtown Toronto, and we recorded it in a rock studio, or a studio that was mostly used for rock. And I was very grateful for that, because when we were done, Glenn sat down at the piano and started doing a little, concert for me. So that's the only time I ever got to hear Glenn live. And it was about 6 a.m. and I was falling asleep, and I just kept telling myself, "Wake up, you fool. Glenn Gould is playing the piano for you." Because I was 9 when he did his last performance. And by that point, I'd talked with him, let me not over-exaggerate, I'd probably talked to him 40, 50 hours on the phone. But this is the only time I met him. And as I say, 3 days, and then almost exactly a month later, he had his stroke
right,
and then died.
Right.
And we never thought that that was going to ever be used. We thought it was going to be played once to sell the record, and then life would go on as usual. But then suddenly he was dead, and Ed Rothstein's wonderful obituary in the New York Times took him very, very seriously as a thinker. And Glenn and I had already started talking about maybe doing a book of his work, and of course that led to the Glenn Gould Reader, which was my first serious
and
book.
It is still a great book and a great reference book, and You know, people keep telling me, you know, there are other writings. There are other writings, and you know, I mean.
Oh yeah, but we got all the ones we could find then. And if I had to make any criticism about the Glenn Gould Reader, I won't say pressured, but I was encouraged to include everything we found, because way back in 1983, we thought, well, maybe this will be the only book about Glenn Gould. So we used everything. And if I could trim it today or do it differently, I would probably cut about 100 pages, because he has a whole lot about Schoenberg, and some of it rather repeats itself, and there's a lot of Bach, and I could make a tighter book. But I'm still glad we did this.
Right.
I
have to say, and now it's been a while since I read this, so I may be misremembering, but as I recall, there is, am I right, a review of a P.D.Q. Bach concert in which he comes to the conclusion that he's finally found the source of the theme for the Enigma variations in the works of P.D.Q. Bach?
You know, I have to say it's a very long time ago, and I don't remember off the top of my head.
I think that's in there. And honestly, the idea is so absurd and so funny that it makes me smile just thinking about it right now. But anyway, because of course, P.D.Q. Bach didn't really exist.
And poor Peter Schickele has just died recently.
Yes, very sad. He was actually on one of our prize juries, and he was lovely. Yes,
lovely man. Lovely.
So it was also especially delightful to see him shift effortlessly into the voice of Theodore Slutz in the middle of the conversation, which was great. I would love, if I'd been around, I would have encouraged him to record a piece called The Wit and Wisdom of Theodore Slutz, because it would have been hilarious. Anyway, but it's also interesting on a more serious vein, the conversations about Strauss. I think the moment you really got him was when you told him that you loved the Metamorphosen, because of course he said, I think, that there a day never passed by in his adult life that he didn't think about or in his mind play the Metamorphosen.
And it's become so popular now, and it was not popular then. There were all sorts of reasons it wasn't popular, and we know a great deal more about Strauss, and it's become a favorite of a lot of different conductors now. Dohnányi recorded it, Salonen recorded it, a lot of people record it. There's a gorgeous performance of it being played by a group of musicians in a room with a whole bunch of suitcases behind them online somewhere. And they're playing it basically live. It's really become one of, I would guess, one of Strauss's maybe 10 most famous
Absolutely.
Pieces.
And of course, one of the most complex and rich and yes. Interestingly, I've mentioned this on the Gould Standard in the past, but I don't know whether I've ever mentioned it to you, that I studied with Jeffrey Paisant while he was in the middle of writing his book, which was, in fact, you know, the first sort of analytical, you know, sort of idea biography.
Oh, yeah.
And Jeffrey said, you know, it's impossible to estimate the pivotal role that Glenn played in resurrecting the reputation of Strauss, that he was perhaps more responsible than anyone else from saving him from the people who were sort of, you know, seriously into dodecaphony and, you know, really considered Strauss to either be, you know, hopelessly mired in the past or a Nazi or hopelessly mired in the past Nazi, and that Gould really had been the person who restored him to being one of the pivotal composers of, well, of the 20th century, but in fact of all of Western musical history.
Absolutely. I mean, William Mann and Norman Del Mar had also started to beat the drum for Strauss. But yeah, I remember my my composition teacher, a very, very good man named Charles Jones, who actually grew up in Tamworth, Ontario. And he was so shocked when I started saying, you know, why doesn't anyone ever play this music? And, you know, the problem with Metamorphosen was that Strauss wrote it at the end of the war, And he wrote it as a mournful look back at what Germany once was, and now it had just fallen to into terrible, terrible nonsense and horror. And so that's why he wrote it. But especially immediately after the war, a lot of people thought it was some kind of farewell to Hitler, which of course was the exact opposite of what Strauss was thinking about. But you will find that in some of the writing about it in the years afterwards. So it had a very bad rep. And finally, people researched it and people started listening to it and realizing, like...
Exactly, exactly. And of course, you know, you're quite rightly talk with Glenn and identify some of those remarkable, transcendent, out of time, out of zeitgeist pieces like the Oboe Concerto and like the Four Last Songs. And, you know, I can add also like the Happy Workshop and, you know, things that really connect him to Mozart, connect him to, you know, the great period of the 19th century and show that there is this continuation that never was broken, regardless. I wonder, you know, I've never really done any reading about what the relationship, if any, was between Schoenberg and Strauss. I should actually know this. It's probably very well documented. But anyway, so that, I think, really comes through. And, of course, it's wonderful that Glenn talks about the documentary that he was working on, a two-part documentary, a conversation piece. You've heard that documentary?
On Strauss, yes. But I didn't hear it for many years after that.
Right, and it's a magnificent piece. It really is, and you know the use of Strauss's music. I mean, there's a particular moment that I find very, very moving, where he brings in the slow movement. I can't remember what the title is from Bourgeois Gentilhomme, which kind of informs the entire title of the piece because he called him the bourgeois hero. I'm spending this length of time on Strauss because he illustrates something very, yeah.
May I hold you back just one second? Because I want to mention very quickly a piece that Glenn Gould did about Strauss, which I did know and which I greatly admire, which is the talk about Strauss on the CBC with Humphrey Burton from the mid-60s, which is a fabulous introduction.
Yes,
to Strauss.
It absolutely is, and I think is available to be seen now, so people should
very
see
definitely.
It.
Very definitely.
But the discussion of both Strauss and Sibelius, I think, illustrates something really important about Glenn, which is Glenn's lifelong dedication to, as he called it, walking against the zeitgeist, and his love of composers who really don't belong in any one period of time. They're of all times and of no time in particular, because they're not driven by the trends, the groupthink, the, you know, commonly accepted ideas about what is an appropriate style for this moment in history. And of course, Strauss is in many ways a perfect exemplar, and Sibelius in many ways too. If you think of the 20th century as the century of the 12 tone period and of Stravinsky and this sort of, you know,
To some extent.
Well,
yeah.
But I think that was kind of a common perception for a long time. And then if you really look back at the 20th century and realize this incredible proliferation in a vast, vast array of styles, you know, many of which do fit into no particular period. And I think that that's something that really Glenn was truly drawn to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very definitely.
So... with that reflection, let us leave off from this commentary on part one of Glenn's conversation with you, our guest, Tim Page. And friends, we'll be back for part two. Please join us.